Next month, world population experts will gather in Cairo for the United Nations Conference on Population and Development. The meeting comes at a time when some environmentalists are warning that the world could experience severe food shortages in the next century if food production does not keep pace with global population growth. The population of India alone is expected to reach 1 billion people shortly after the year 2000 if it keeps growing at present rates, raising questions about how the world's second most populous country will feed itself. 30 years ago, people predicted India would face serious food shortages and famine now, but that was averted thanks to a massive program to modernize the country's agriculture and boost its productivity. Now, population growth is running neck and neck with food production, and India stands at another crossroads. Some researchers are again forecasting disaster unless the country can quickly find a way to produce still more food. In the first of a series on global population issues, searching for solutions, leading up to the conference in Cairo, Sandy Tolan looks at India's efforts to feed its people.
Through the farmhouse shutters come the sounds of morning incantations. In the North Indian dawn, the prayers of the Sikh temple echo from village loudspeakers across newly planted fields of wheat. This is the Punjab state of northern India. Perhaps you remember Punjab for the Sikh separatist movement of the 1980s and the Indian government's harsh crackdown and the subsequent assassination of Prime Minister Indira Gandhi. But Punjab has spawned another, quieter revolution over the last 28 years, a revolution that many believe has kept millions of Indians from starvation. Here in the flat, fertile lands near the Pakistani border, India came to feed herself with something called the Green Revolution.
The fog is so dense.
Bhupinder Singh Mann, one of the original Green Revolution farmers, tucks his long hair beneath a turban, smooths his beard, and walks into the cool morning.
See, this orchard has many good points.
We stroll past stacks of firewood and humpbacked mounds of hay into his field of wheat. A ground fog lies in the apple orchard. A barefoot servant walks through the silver mist, bringing us steaming cups of ginger tea.
Please have.
In the late 1960s, Bhupinder Singh Mann and his fellow Punjab farmers became heroes in India. The country had been heavily dependent on food aid from the United States, but after a series of droughts led to food shortages and worries of famine, Indian officials decided the country had to become self-sufficient. So they imported 18,000 tons of new miracle seeds developed by American plant breeder Norman Borlaug. The seeds doubled and tripled harvests.
I was enthused initially with the fact that the yield increased.
The Green Revolution did not solve hunger in India, but by the 1970s, it had provided enough grain to be a huge buffer against famine. Norman Borlaug had won a Nobel Peace Prize, and Punjab farmers, with their modern technology of irrigation, tractors, fertilizers, and miracle seeds, were famous around the world. But the miracle had its price. In his pink turban and Nehru jacket, Mann tells a story recounted by many Green Revolution farmers around the world of what went wrong.
Fertilizers came in.
The seeds would only give high yields if used with chemical fertilizers. But each year, he had to put more fertilizer on the soil just to meet production of the year before, and more chemical pesticides.
The soil doesn't respond.
The more he added, the more his soils grew sterile. The more his water table became contaminated, the more his costs shot up.
No doubt I have produced much more than I used to. But the benefits of more production, they have gone to somebody else. This Green Revolution has not helped me in any way.
Sipping his tea, Bhupinder Singh Mann tells me he no longer considers it his patriotic duty to feed a nation. He's increasing his plantings of sugarcane and wants to sell his wheat on the global export market.
I am happy to contribute for feeding the poor. But it has been on my shoulders only. It should not be my only responsibility that I should feed everybody.
When the Green Revolution began in India, Bhupinder Singh Mann and his fellow Indian farmers were providing grain for 450 million people. Now there are nearly twice that many Indians. Their food will have to come from the same amount of land. And there's been significant damage to much of the land that's produced their food so far. According to an extensive study of Indian agriculture by the World Resources Institute, over the last two decades, 6% of India's arable land, or 1 million acres a year, have gone out of production, made sterile from waterlogging and salinity. Huge tracts have been lost to soil erosion. To offset these losses, some farmers have planted two crops a year on irrigated lands. But irrigation has seriously depleted water tables. Across millions of coastal acres, farmers have pumped down so far that seawater has infiltrated, ruining aquifers. Some say the entire Green Revolution model is not sustainable. On first look, all this would seem to put Indian agricultural production in a real fix. I wonder what officials in the capital have to say about this.
My name is S.K. Sinha. I am the director of Indian Agriculture Research Institute.
Dr. Sinha speaks from his red brick government offices in New Delhi. Right now, India produces 180 million tons of grain per year. By the turn of the century, Dr. Sinha says, the country will need to increase its production to 226 million tons.
So in next 6 years, that means we should produce 46 million tons more, which probably would not happen. The population growth rate as it is possibly would not be matched by the crop improvement rate unless some miracle happens.
Barring miracles, what will happen? The Prime Minister says India can expand its production by moving the Green Revolution into other parts of the country. And other officials say an adequate supply of grain will be assured by financial incentives for farmers to intensify their production. Others aren't so sure. Devinder Sharma, author of a recent book on the politics of agriculture in India, agrees the potential is there. But he says the government is ignoring serious impending shortages.
Last 5 years, let's say, we haven't had a real growth in agriculture. This is not because there's something wrong with our farmers. Complacency has come up into Indian agriculture. Looking at the growth of population in the years to come, we would be reaching about 1 billion by the end of this century. We have a gap of 50 million tons to cover up in the remaining 6 years of this century, which is a very difficult task. We are not in a position to achieve that target unless we take corrective steps right now.
A lot of people in India say the country needs a second Green Revolution, a green revolution, another great leap in food production without the ecological fallout. But is this really possible? To find out, I head toward the south of India. A 1,000 miles away, a woman in a green sari bangs a pan with a metal spoon to scare away the birds from newly planted experimental crops. This is ICRISAT, the multi-million dollar International Crops Research Institute for the semi-arid tropics. With its plant breeding labs, refrigerated seed banks, and testing fields for high-yielding hybrids, ICRISAT's 4,000 acres are enough to house several thousand family farms in India.
Yeah, this is the sprayed area. This is insecticide use, and this is no insecticide use. This has been harvested.
Merle Anders, former Iowa farm boy, rolls an ICRISAT pickup truck past rows of sorghum and pearl millet.
What we're finding is quite interesting.
In his shorts and Albert Einstein t-shirt, he points to fields planted in new hybrid seeds to push the yields of basic food grains ever higher.
Trying to produce.
On this day-long tour, I've learned of ICRISAT's newest challenge, to get highly productive crops without, as one official said, blowing the environment out of the water. More careful spraying of pesticides, for example, or breeding pest-resistant seeds. Yet these plans emanate from the same institution that helped engineer the high chemical Green Revolution. Even Anders sounds skeptical.
You need to put some proof up on board that
yeah, it isn't business as usual. It isn't just a better way to write a research request.
How much is this really any different, the sustainability stuff?
Very little, I think. Very, very little. If you look back, there have probably been buzzwords, as we call them, that have come and gone.
But buzzwords aside, Merle Anders says there may be only so much any agricultural research can do in the face of growing population, especially when you consider, he says, stopping in front of endless rows of sorghum stalks, that in some cases, breeding for basic food grains may be reaching their upper limits.
Look at the miracle rice, the miracle wheat areas. Big jumps. We now know that yields are stabilizing, if not decreasing, with more fertilizer, more chemicals, etc. You cannot, it's not good enough to stabilize even if it's at a higher level, because that sooner or later the demands will outrun that. There may be a point where population pressure does create havoc with food supply. That almost has to happen. How do you handle that? It is a mess to think about, the whole thing.
And it's a mess I've been hearing about ever since I arrived in India. I wonder, is anyone in India producing a lot of food without using chemicals? After weeks of asking around, I hear of a place on India's eastern shore near Madras in the Bay of Bengal, a place called Gloria Land.
When I came to this farm, not a single tree existed. Now you see. Coconuts alone are 2,000.
Warm and tropical, Gloria Land stands in sharp relief to the cool, misty stillness of the Punjab's Green Revolution wheat fields. This organic farm, run by a man named Manindra Pal, has an entirely different feel.
This is the vibrant of life. The vibrations of life. Look there. The birds, I mean, they were probably collecting some insects. If I had sprayed, definitely they wouldn't be there. Yes, demonstrate to my friend.
Manindra Pal walks down a dirt path between long stretches of rice paddy toward the workers bending over in the bright sun. An old man in a turban and loincloth, then women in saris and scarves, separate the rice husks from the grain. 25 years ago, this paddy would have been infused with chemicals. In fact, Pal used to be a Green Revolution farmer, but pesticide spraying made him sick. So in the heyday of the Green Revolution, to the astonishment of other farmers, Manindra Pal abandoned all chemicals and set out to prove in his 100 acres of rice just how much you could grow organically.
Once upon a time, people used to call me a crazy fellow. But the fact it exists, so that nobody can deny the fact that it can be done. With high productivity, much higher. My yield is increasing every year.
Pal says all you have to do is look around your farm and see what's lying there getting wasted. His ingredients are simple: cow dung, cow urine, and leaves. Every ounce of cow manure is used, pumped into biomass pipes to fuel the farm kitchen, then washed back out into the fields as a natural fertilizer.
So your manure is available always.
But this practice hasn't spread very far into the fields of India. Many farmers prefer fertilizers. The price is heavily subsidized by the government. Also, Paul's 100 acres are much larger than the average Indian farm. Even he admits on many smaller farms, there's competition for cow dung. It's used also as cooking fuel, and there's simply not enough to go around. So if Manindra Pal's model of organic farming cannot be translated to the rest of India's farms, what about the other end of the spectrum? Genetic engineering of plants. Back in Delhi, at the university named after the nation's first president, Jawaharlal Nehru, I find geneticist Krishna Tiwari.
No matter what happens, what people talk, India's population one day will be 2 billion. There is nothing to stop this population growth. So that's a given. Can we do something?
His population estimates may be a bit high, but the point remains the same.
Now we have to really redesign the plant in such a way that it will be dramatically more productive.
Using genetic fingerprinting, Tiwari and his colleagues identified a particular chromosome resistant to a common insect that attacks rice in India. Tiwari says with breakthroughs like this, scientists could engineer a whole new range of plants that fight off pests and use less water and stay rooted in high winds and grow on poor soils. In theory, this could increase food production, But that's not the direction agricultural biotechnology appears to be headed in. Food geneticists and seed experts around the world worry that because of the privatization of agricultural research, sustainable food production is getting shunted aside. Most research of genetic engineering of seeds is in the hands of multinational chemical companies, and most of their research is in developing seeds that are able to withstand heavy doses of herbicides.
What they're really looking for is larger sales of chemicals.
This is the noted Indian social critic, Vandana Shiva.
They're very clear about their investments not being for meeting the food needs of the large numbers of people on this planet. I see no indication that they will be a solution to hunger because they're not addressing hunger.
And hunger exists in abundance in India. Despite the success of the Green Revolution in growing more food, and despite India's many programs to distribute food cheaply, there are still more hungry people in India than there are people in the United States.
Hello.
Back up in the Punjab, a row of mud houses stands at the edge of a prosperous wheat field. 14 families live, 8 and 10 people each, in rooms slightly larger than tool sheds. 40 people crowd around us, staring at the microphone, as my interpreter, Gagan Gill, speaks to a slight man in an open shirt and rolled up pants.
I am Gurnam Masi from Sherpur village in Batala district of Punjab.
Like nearly 200 million other people in rural India, Gunam Masi and his wife Piari have no land. Former untouchables, they converted to Christianity to try to escape their fate. For this family, the availability of food grains in the future is not the issue. It's the availability of work and money today.
We still do the traditional work of scavenging. This is all we can do. We cannot do anything else. My name is Piari. I remove the cow dung from the cattle places. I clean the place. I remove the trash from the homes.
Piari shapes the balls of cow dung into fuel for the ovens of her higher caste neighbors. For 25 years, this has been her work. Her pay is in wheat, about a pound a day, sometimes less. It depends, she tells us, on how well she's worked.
We can survive for 2 to 3 months on this wheat. After that, we have to fend for ourselves.
Before we leave, I ask Piari, how can you describe hunger? She looks at me as if to say, what a strange thing to ask. And then she tries to answer.
I think it is impossible to describe hunger. I can only say if you are hungry, you cannot even remember God.
For these landless former untouchables, it doesn't matter how many mountains of wheat or rice or mile-high piles of potatoes India produces. It's like the scene in Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, where men with shotguns stand guard over golden hills of oranges. All the food you need can be just across the road or in the wheat field at the edge of your hamlet. But just because the food is there doesn't mean you can have it.
So many families don't manage to capture, to manage to command food in the market, despite there being so much food around.
Amartya Sen, a global expert on hunger and famine, says it's not enough to focus just on producing more food.
I think food production is important in any sense, and in many contexts, there is a case for putting a great deal of emphasis exactly in that direction. The only problem is that if you look only at that, I think you're in great danger of missing out something very significant. We have to be much more concerned about those critical people whose ability to buy food is limited.
But soon, insist some worried researchers back in the capital, it may not be just India's poor who suffer hunger if the government doesn't confront the urgency of producing more food and soon.
We are not really addressing ourselves to this problem here and now.
Baswaji Dar of New Delhi's Information and Research Systems think tank.
In a decade or so, when India becomes the most populous country and we're really going to have a population explosion of sorts, I think it's going to be in a kind of a collapse of the entire system. And it's, And I see that coming. You know, I don't see any way in which we can avoid this impending collapse if we keep going the way we are going.
Government officials insist the picture isn't so gloomy. India is in the midst of opening up to the global economy, increasing exports, and inviting multinational investments in agriculture. Officials say this will help modernize Indian farms and make them more productive.
As we move towards better agricultural practices, better control of water, better irrigation.
This is the Indian Finance Secretary, Mantek Singh Ahluwalia.
The scope for yield improvement through better investment in agriculture, modern technology, the higher income generated by agricultural producers feeds back into better investment on their fields. I mean, India has the scope very easily to double yields per acre.
Advocates of free trade say with India's newly opened economy, the country will also be able to import the food it needs with the hard currency it earns from expanding exports. Some economists ask, why shouldn't India import wheat and rice if it can pay for it by exporting kiwi fruit and spices? But Indian leaders insist they will never return to the ship-to-mouth days of the 1960s, when the country had to rely on grain shipments from abroad for its basic food security. As population heads toward 1 billion, critics and the government agree on this. If India is going to feed its people, she's going to have to do it herself. This is Sandy Tolan reporting.